Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 119 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling Part 2, Trade is a Many Splendored Thing, with Vince Peterson. I've been going to U.S. Wheat Associates meetings for more than 25 years, first as a reporter for Capital Press, and for the last 11 years as a staff member of the WGC. Remember the phrase, follow the money? It's a line made famous from the Watergate era, but it's always a good idea, even when there are no nefarious shenanigans. Budget committee meetings at U.S. Wheat Associates became a mandatory part of my attendance back in the days when challenges facing the organization were mighty and opportunities were meager. I wouldn't say all budget committee meetings were bleak, but there were some with a lot of head-shaking going on as staff and officers looked for solutions while tightening belts. Today, there's a different kind of head-shaking going on at USW, and it's not over how to balance the budget. Thanks to the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program called ATP, a Trump-inspired initiative intended to help U.S. agricultural exporters develop new markets and mitigate the adverse effects from other countries' tariff and non-tariff barriers, the head-shaking is over the organization's budgetary good fortune. Not only did USW receive $8.25 million in ATP funding over 3 years, but an additional $700,000 came its way thanks to increased Foreign Market Development Program funding. Together, that means the USW budget will rise from $16.3 million in 2018 to $19.3 million in 2019. That raises the number of times producer funds are matched by the federal government from 1.7 times in 2018 to 2.4 times in 2019. USW will see three payments of $2.75 million each over the next 3 years from the ATP funding. Ahead, you'll hear USW President Vince Peterson describe the varied projects USW plans to carry out thanks to the extra money. Although China is in the forefront of the media's interest lately, for the wheat industry, Peterson believes the bigger challenge is the result of U.S. absence from the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the impact that might have on our most important long-term market, Japan. Although most of you already know this, President Trump's withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, called TPP, resulted in the remaining 11 countries negotiating their own deal called the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. As a result, Canadian and Australian wheat into Japan started getting cheaper in January 1st of this year. On April 1st, U.S. wheat became $20 a ton more expensive than both competitors' wheat. As you'll hear Peterson say ahead, we have to get that fixed. The U.S. is no longer the number one exporter of wheat in the world, a position it held from World War II to just a few years ago. But Peterson said considering the growth of the world wheat market that's already occurred and that which is forecast to happen, opportunities abound. Consider, over the next 20 years, Peterson is anticipating the U.S. will have the opportunity to service 12 million additional tons of demand in Latin America and Asia. That's a 40% increase over current U.S. exports. But it will take quality wheat to fill orders. I asked Peterson about the recent shift at USW from famine to feast.
For us, it's a little bit feast or famine. You mentioned that we didn't have a farm bill until just 20th of December or sometime in that area. So we were frankly without funding authority on our programs starting October 1st with the beginning of the fiscal year. So we had no funding authority in our FMD program January 1st, no funding on our MAP program. We had lower budgets going to that. We had lower producer budgets in it. So we were kind of like choked a little bit on money, particularly with the government shutdown. So fast forward a week, and we got our application for our ATP funding in. That was almost, by any government measure, lightning speed. From the time they announced that program to the time we applied for it, we applied for a little over $14 million of additional funding over 3 years. We got $8.25 million of the 14 that we asked for. That's a fantastic return, I think. It's proportional to our participation in MAP and FMD. So I think it was a fair we weren't greedy about it. We asked for what we thought was reasonable, and I think we got a very good outcome on that. But at the same time, the next week we got our finally with the farm bill in and USDA back at work, we got our MAP and FMD numbers, and we got about $700,000 more in total out of those two programs that we got last year. Part of that's based on, it's quite a formula that they go through and based on performance and measurements and goals and a bunch of things that only they know what they look at. But nevertheless, between the two programs, I think Jennifer said it, she got possession of funding of about $18.9 million in a week's time. So this is a tremendous boost for us. I mean, it allows us to do a whole bunch of things that we need to do, particularly in this trade environment, what I call the apology tour to Mexico, and a whole bunch of other technical and marketing activities that we've just been pinned up with for because of funding constraints a little bit. So it's just a real breath of fresh air for us and welcome, and we've got the capacity to handle it. So it'll be a good deal for us.
So you got more than $8 million in these ATP funds. What does ATP stand for?
Agricultural Trade Program.
So this money is not going to be ongoing forever. Tell me about these funds and how you will use them in the near term.
Yeah. They have essentially, after a lot of trials and tribulations, emulated the MAP program and their allocation of this stuff. So we submitted activity by activity application. It was 200 activities spread all around all of our offices, and they're everything from trade conferences to technical activities to seminars to one-on-one visits. I mean, we pulled the stops out. We've got the gamut of every possible activity that we could think of, that even things we're not doing presently. When they gave us that allocation for that, it's not that it's unbridled, but it is extremely flexible. We can use that for almost any of those activities we want. So we prioritize that. We take the $8.25 million, and we're doing that right now, prioritizing regions, countries, markets, where we feel we're going to get the biggest bang for the buck out of those things. It's a three-year program, so we can apportion it. In theory, if we had something, we could spend it all on day one, or we could spend it all on day 1,050 or whatever it is, but we're going to apportion it. It'll be weighted more in the first year and the second year and less in the third year, because the idea of this is to try to get the money out, get the activities going, and try to stimulate some export business to offset the losses to China and some of these other places that we're experiencing.
Okay, great. But beginning April 1st, Australian and Canadian wheat will be cheaper into Japan. What do you suspect will happen to our market share in Japan after April 1st?
Yeah, this is a big, I would say this is a, you know, the China thing is hitting you right in the face because we've already lost sales in that. But the Japan one, the risk is so great because of our position there. You know, it's been our first or second largest wheat market for a very long time. We've got a high percentage market here. They buy our highest quality wheat. They pay some of the highest prices that we have for sales. So it's a market that we've got this long-term relationship there. So we don't want to erode anything in that market. So you're absolutely right. They start stair-stepping this in January 1. They changed the market. Well, January 1, they made the first change in the markup, and then the next one happens April 1. So that'll be the second, the way the cadence, and then it'll be every April after that. We have to get it fixed, and we're working very hard with both USTR, USDA on our side, but frankly, we've met with MAF just last month. We've met with all of our customers. We're kind of getting a coalition together to address this. We've got to fix it. But the good news is there's a little bit of time by accident in this, and it's just courtesy of the market values. Because even though the markup prices are different, right now with the price situation, in fact, those other ones are not very much cheaper than ours. In fact, Australian wheat prices are so high because of their drought, we're still in the game with Australia. And right now our spring wheat prices, we produce such a great crop of spring wheat, such high protein. Wheat protein is so cheap right now that our spring wheat prices are still competitive. So I'm not saying what we're going to have is a little bit of an opportunity loss. In other words, if we had the similar markup starting April 1st, we'd have an advantage. We'd probably be doing more business than we are. But because of the disparity in the markets, just by accident right now, we probably aren't going to lose very much right now. We've got a little bit of time. If we can get this thing done they were talking earlier, this summer by October, we probably will get by without losing very much in the process. But we're not sitting by to wait for that to happen. We're going to have a proposal to go to the Japanese government and our government that when they sit down at that table the first time, which is going to be somewhere, it's not set yet, but end of March or first of April, we're asking them collectively as an industry from the Japanese bakers to the U.S. farmers to please treat our industries the same as the Canadians and the Australians during the time you're negotiating this agreement. Otherwise, we're going to be harmed from literally almost the consumer to the farmer. We don't want to be in that place. We don't want to be the squeaky wheel having to be harassing you for the next 6 months when you negotiate this stuff. If you'll just please give us equal treatment while you negotiate without prejudice to the agreement, you negotiate whatever you want to do, treat us the same. And so that's our tact. Well, hopefully we'll be successful in getting that done, but that's what staves off the damage potential in between.
Again, fingers crossed.
Yep.
In the Northwest, Vince, we're told that soft white wheat is special because it's a specialty wheat that doesn't have a real challenger around the world, and that might be our silver lining when it comes to the Japanese market. Do you agree or disagree?
I strongly agree with that. Do I say I'm 100% agree? But I strongly agree. If soft white is very unique, and at this moment there's not very much that is a direct substitute for that. The Canadians have made some attempts at growing some soft spring wheat and some things, and there's not very much in Australia that fills into that category. And frankly, I've seen estimates from the Japanese on this circumstance with the markups changing and the prices. And they don't show any themselves. Their own calculations don't show any impact on soft white wheat till about 3 years out, because of the inability to substitute for that stuff. So to make a substitute, they've got to have a really big price differential. I would never be so confident to say that it can't be damaged or can't be hurt, because we've got to get it fixed. But on that one, it's the most secure of all the wheat classes we have, just because of its nature and its use.
Okay, wonderful. U.S. wheat does a lot of trade servicing, that is, sending trained individuals to evaluate overseas milling and baking facilities. Do other wheat organizations around the world do that? And what does it mean for USW and wheat farmers that you do?
Yeah. The short answer is no. No one really does this the way we do it at all. There have been some copycats, I would say. The Canadians have the Canadian Grain Commission, SIGI, the institute in Winnipeg that does technical research and that sort of stuff. But they have a tendency to be more. They'll bring some people back to Canada and do some things in country, and they'll do a crop quality seminar overseas. They don't have 15 overseas offices like we do, in permanent staff and a permanent presence in Tokyo for 65 years and all things. So we are somewhat unique in the world in terms of that. It buys us, I think, a tremendous dividend and a market opportunity. It puts us in the market all the time. We know the people. We know them face to face. It's a place to be in the market that just no others envy. The only way for others to have an advantage in it is just to be cheaper than ours. Or let's be honest, if they have a grain quality that exceeds ours for some reason in the eye of the beholder, okay, we have to still be competitive with those things. We can't rest on the laurels that we've got this great technical servicing and market servicing service that we can provide. But the product's got to follow it. And so that's a big goal of ours, is to make sure our product always follows the service.
Do you plan on expanding trade servicing?
Let's kind of pick that apart just a little bit. I think maybe what you're getting at is the technical side of the servicing, working with the flour mills, the bakeries, those kind of things. So yes, we do a lot of other trade servicing in terms of marketing, risk management, contracting, a bunch of other things on the marketing side as well, which we kind of lump into trade servicing. But I think we feel that the technical part of that our product in the future fits into a marketplace because of its end-use properties. The soft white certainly does. Spring wheat certainly does. Winter wheat's a little harder to differentiate, but we've got to try to do that. So the technical servicing to differentiate those wheats is key. It's key to our market share. It's key to our place, and it's key to our returns on the investment on it. So, yes.
U.S. wheat divides Asia into North Asia and South Asia.
Yep.
Tell me about that division and why you make it.
Yeah, it's more or less just for our own accounting records more than anything else. It's an administrative division. It really doesn't mean much more than that. So we call North Asia a three office grouping, but they're not really grouped. They're not really grouped administratively. They're just kind of in Northern Asia. So Japan, Korea, and Taiwan are in that grouping. And that's just simply for our accounting and administrative purposes. They all have their own programs. They all operate. However, their market is best served within the three countries. South Asia then kind of covers everybody else with the exception of China, and we run that out of Singapore. That's responsible for that, strongly backstopped by our office in the Philippines with Joe Soares, who is responsible for the Philippines, but also then backstops all the South Asia work. So there's more synergies in the South Asian market. There's more synergies between, let's say, the Vietnamese, the Thais, the Malays, the Indonesians, a little more there. We've sort of forced a synergy, I would say, on the North Asians. We've done things together with them. We've put them all in the same room together in seminars and actually we sort of created a little bit of a North Asian identity amongst themselves that I'm not sure if they had previously, but they do. In fact, when we get them together at some of these conferences, they have golf tournaments. The Japanese compete with the Koreans and the Taiwanese and the Americans, and we've created some camaraderie within the North Asians, even though it's sort of perhaps an artificially created geographical region.
But isn't the North Asian region more a first world area, and the South Asian is more of a third world region?
Yeah, you could fairly pick them out and say there's some distinctions. I wouldn't say that's why they were put that way in the first place. Because in fact, when those were put in those categories for us, Korea probably arguably was they were an aid market. I mean, some of these things were not very long after the war when these things started. But today, characteristically, you're exactly right. I mean, these are mature markets. They're generally technically competent markets. For example, we don't go to Japan and tell Nissin Milling how to mill wheat. I mean, they can tell us more than we need to know. And we don't try to tell Yamazaki Bakery how to bake bread. So there are different markets. They're mature. They're technically competent. Their knowledge of markets and what they need is very high. So the programs are different for those three markets. But again, each market, our Tokyo office will tailor something for the Japanese, which is different than the Koreans. Even though they're both mature markets, the Koreans were still doing a lot of product research and we're doing a lot of work with the flour mills and a lot of work with the bakery industry and stuff. Not so much in Japan. They're just different in that. But you're right. You characterize South Asia, you take that group of countries. Maybe if we don't say third world, but let's say developing countries. They're all developing countries, and in some way they're all somewhat unique. For example, the Thai market in Thailand is entirely different than in Indonesia, just across the channel. But that's all right. They're not all the same, but we can address them. And they become more, for us, geographically easily located. For South Asia, somebody in Singapore can service Thailand just as well as in Indonesia, even though the programs are different for the two, but they're regionally similar locations.
Okay, and we're also looking south to Latin America.
Yes.
What's the penetration in Latin America now, and where would you like it to be in 5 years?
Yeah, there's these two regions you've just outlined. The Asian markets from the north to the south is right now probably occupying, well, better than 40, probably 45% of our export business is going there. But darn close to 40% of our export business is going from everything from Mexico down to Chile and Brazil across. So these are all growing areas. The Latin American market, by my measure, and I could argue whether it's completely accurate or not, is going to need to import an additional 10 million tons of wheat in about the next 20 years. So it's not your five-year timeline, but let's say it's a little longer. But that's 10 million tons more than they're importing right now, because most of those are not wheat-producing nations. Mexico produces a little bit. Most of them don't. They're not wheat producers. So they're right on our doorstep. They particularly Mexico is direct rail. It's almost like a domestic market. But all the rest of those, from Guatemala to Honduras to El Salvador to Colombia, Peru, all the way down, that ought to be our bread and butter. And we ought to have, let's say, round figures, at least 50% of that business, just in general down there. So that's another 5 million tons of export sales that I see, and maybe that's a 20-year period, but I could add Asia onto that and make that bigger. So when you look at the health of our industry, this is why I'm very optimistic about it. Unfortunately, with all the dynamics, we're not really producing more wheat. We're producing, if it's any more, it's only because of agronomic improvements and varietal improvements and farming practice and all those things. We're not putting more land area into wheat. Now, that might change. But let's say we stay at an area we're producing around 60 million tons of wheat and we're consuming half of it and we have to export 30 more or less. If we get five more million tons of additionality out of South America, that's a huge impact out of that 30 million tons for us. That's a big deal. And that would be a huge impact on wheat prices alone just to have that. It shores up our S&D. It shores up our stock holding, our stocks to use ratio, all those things. Make the same analysis in Asia. If you could look at all those countries, you're probably more like 20 million tons of additional business. Now, maybe we're not doing 50% across all of Asia. We are in Japan, but let's say we did 30% of that business. U.S., Canada's got a third, Australia's got a third, we've got a third. That's another 7 million tons of potential U.S. export business. Well, between the two of those, that potential is huge in terms of its impact on our business and our position, unless we start growing a lot more wheat someplace.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You did mention that we're not growing any more wheat as we look out, 10, 20 years, and therefore our market share is going to decline. Now, I know that USW's priority is to provide profit to farmers and not necessarily sell more wheat, but isn't market share tied to profit?
No.
No?
No, no. Because you have to define the term. And in our particular case, if you're talking about market share of the Japan market, I might say yes, because that's a fixed market. It's a 6 million ton market. We get 50%, that's 3 million tons. If Japan doesn't change, then if we lose market share in Japan, yes, that's a direct link. But when we're talking about the world marketplace, which is what most people talk about, market shares, we used to have 40%, now we've got 15. Oh, woe is us. Problem is that pie has gone from 90 million tons 30 years ago to 180 million tons today, and 30 years from now or 25 years from now, that pie is going to be 270 million tons. The trade pie is so much bigger. So we can lose market share of this 270 million ton pie and still have our 30 million ton piece, but our piece has got the ice cream, the whipped cream, the nuts, the cherries, everything else on it. That's the piece of the 270 million ton pie that we want. And so that's where the profitability comes back from. We want the most profitable piece. We want the best piece of that pie, and we want to give the rest of it to those who want to fight over the scraps.
Peterson has an orbiculum, also known as a crystal ball, in his office. And while he's not a soothsayer, the fortune-telling device is a wonderful prop for explaining what he does for a living. As president of U.S. Wheat Associates, his job is to make sure the organization and the farmers it represents are prepared for the future that he foresees, not in the crystal ball, but in the voluminous data that flows across his desk daily. The market may be mired in bad news at the moment, but people will always need to eat, not to mention the planet is still on track to grow by around 2 billion mouths in the next 30 years. I'm not a soothsayer either, but I can't find fault in Peterson's logic that anticipates a growing world market for quality wheat. So I say to my farmer friends, hang in there for the present and be prepared for a brighter future. That's all the time we have. I hope you've enjoyed part two of Trade is a Many Splendored Thing with Vince Peterson. Please join me again next week for another episode of Wheat All About It.
Out in the country where a woman's called a gal, she's more than a lover, she's a farmer's best pal. We marry them for life, we marry with a vow, and even in the night we know how to plow. Our children have two parents, our children have a home, they don't grow up with no edible syndrome. We're the backbone of this country, the spirit of its soul. best you ask, for whom the bell tolls, we feed you.